Thank you very much, Bishop Mark, and all of you for turning up in what must be a graveyard slot, really. It's I don't know how heavy a lunch people have had, but if you do nod off, I shan't mind. I may nod off myself. Who knows? The reason that Bishop Mark and I agreed this topic for this afternoon is that so many of the issues that face the church, and there are so many, aren't there? We sort of weary of them sometimes, thinking what next is coming on along the horizon. But so many of them, if not all of them, have actually to do with the person and the work of Jesus Christ in the end. And so I hope it is of some help to us all as we think about Christ and his people, Christ and his church, this afternoon a little. As Bishop Mark has indicated already, there will be plenty of room for interaction, not perhaps by mobile telephone, but certainly personally here. George Carey, in his introduction to that book, tells the story of being on a train. And there was a man sitting opposite him, and possibly because George was wearing a dog collar, the man started speaking to him and said how much he admired Jesus the man. So George listened to this for a while, and then eventually he said, but you know, he wasn't just a man. And so at that, the man drew back, or drew himself up, and said rather stiffly, there we must beg to, I must beg to disagree, there we must disagree. And George says he promptly got off the train. Well, I said to George, I hope that the train had stopped in the meantime. But it does illustrate, I think, certainly in the Western world, how people are quite willing to talk about Jesus as a good man, as an admired teacher, and all sorts of things like that. But if you want to say something about what Christians believe, then, of course, that's more difficult. This was illustrated for me personally. On one occasion, I had put my name down to lead a debate in the House of Lords on some rather general topic like religion and its role in society or something. And the civil servants, important people, civil servants, and they control everything, they said to me, they said, Bishop, the person who has put his name down immediately after you to speak is one of our leading atheist members, and he will try and rubbish more or less everything that you say in the debate. So I said, fine, okay, thank you for warning me. Sure enough, in the debate, I made my introductory speech, and then this man got up and said no to almost everything I'd said about the importance of faith in society. And then, as it were, the Lord gave him into my hands, because he said, quite gratuitously and without any reason to do so, he said, well, of course, when I need to make moral decisions, I go to the Sermon on the Mount. So, right, yeah. Those who are leading these debates have the opportunity to wind up when everyone else has spoken. So I took him up on this. I said, well, why believe what he says in the Sermon on the Mount and not anything else that he says? But Philip Pullman, I don't know if he's read here, you know, the so-called children's author, I think we must say so-called children's author, because I think what he writes is not really just for children. But he has written this book called The Good Man, Jesus, and the Scoundrel Christ. Yeah, that's the title. In which, it's a fantasy, by his own admission, in which he imagines that Mary gave birth to twins, Jesus and Christ, and Jesus was the good man and did all the good things and said all the right things, and Christ was the problem. You see? Christ is the problem. I think this is So what we have, certainly in the contemporary Western world, is a kind of vestigial, sometimes affectionate memory about Jesus. It is vague, it is not defined in any way, but it is there. But the hostility arises very often when you try and say something more. Islam, on the other hand, the problem is quite different, because Islam's understanding of Jesus is quite precise, but at the same time, not Christian. Well, that's obvious in a way. Otherwise, it wouldn't be Islam, would it? Islam's view of Jesus can be divided really into three. There is, first of all, the view that is found in the Quran, which is basically a doctrinal view. The interest of the Quran in Jesus is basically doctrinal. Who he is, what he is not. So, for instance, the Quran repeatedly says that he is Jesus, the Messiah, the son of Mary, he's a prophet, he's an apostle, by which the Quran means someone sent by God. But he is not son of God, he is not the second person of the Blessed Trinity, he did not die on the cross, etc., etc. Apart from these direct references, there are also many indirect denials of Christian belief. So one of the surahs that Muslims recite when they pray, the ritual prayer, five times a day, is the surah called Al-Ikhlas, 112, which denies that God can beget or is begotten, and is a direct refutation of Christian creedal statements. The hadith, the stories about the Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, on the other hand, the interest there is not so much doctrinal as what you might call eschatological. It is about what will happen at the end of time. So Jesus will return to earth, alighting, as some say, on one of the gates of Damascus. I hope it's not anywhere near Homs, if it's going to be very soon. But the gates of Damascus are therefore very important in Muslim eschatology. And he will break down all the crosses. You see. So the attack on the crosses in the British graveyard in Libya, you know, these people are doing the work that Jesus will do. I mean, they're probably helping him along so that he doesn't have to destroy so many when he comes. He will destroy the crosses. He will kill Jews. I mean, I'm just quoting. He will. All the Christians, of course, will become Muslims, and they will pray behind Jesus, who will pray behind Muhammad. So that's the kind of eschatology of the hadith, the Quran, the hadith, and then finally there is a view of Jesus in Sufism, in Muslim mysticism, which is different again, which is really about seeing Jesus as the supreme ascetic, who has given up everything for God and is to be followed in as an example in this renunciation of his. And so there's a great deal in Sufism about Jesus, who has given up everything for God, but also Jesus as the one who heals by the breath of his mouth. Jesus as the healer. In fact, the term Masiha in Arabic, Messiah, is connected to an Arabic word meaning someone who heals by their breath. And this has strengthened the idea in the Islamic world, very important for mission there, by the way, of Jesus as the one who heals. So you have the secular view of Jesus and the distinction that people make between Jesus and the Christ. You have the three aspects of the Islamic view. Hinduism is quite interesting because apart from people who are Christians in India, there is a very large number of Hindus who are devoted only to Jesus. Then, of course, there's an even larger number of people who find some room for devotion to Jesus. Many of these people think of Jesus in Hindu terms. So one of the titles used for Jesus quite often by such people is Sach Guru, that is to say, the true guru. And his work is interpreted in Hindu terms, in terms of liberation from physical life and from the cycle of death and rebirth and, you know, transmigration and so forth. So he is not at all seen in Christian terms, in biblical terms, but he's understood almost as another Hindu incarnation of a god. Well, not almost. He is understood like that. The Jewish view of Jesus is, of course, one that has changed recently, quite dramatically in some ways. When you think of the Talmud says that Jesus was put to death because he deceived the people. Yeah? And the old Jewish history, the Toledot Yeshua, says, well, it repeats those old things about Jesus being illegitimate and born of an illegitimate union and so forth. Now, those Jewish-Christian polemics, the cursing of the Minim in the synagogues and so forth, has since the Second World War, with the great improvement in Jewish-Christian relations, resulted in a large-scale reassessment of Jesus by Jews. So Professor Geza Vermish, the foremost Dead Sea Scroll scholar, and I count him a friend and very privileged to be a friend of his, but he thinks of Jesus as one of the Hasidim, one of the righteous Jews. One of the tasks, of course, of the Hasidim is not just to be pious, but to do kind works, works of kindness. Again, another rabbi, a friend of mine, Dan Cohn Sherbock, who is from the more liberal tradition in Judaism, thinks of Jesus as a prophet of the Old Testament type. Well, there is something in that, because the Gospels also speak of Jesus as a prophet. And then Rabbi Pinchas Lapide, as you know, has said in writing that there is no problem for Jewish people in believing the resurrection of Jesus, because this is what Judaism teaches about those who die for God's sake in a righteous cause, that they will be raised to life. And so if Jesus was raised to life again, that shouldn't be a problem. There's a very interesting dialogue between Lapide and Hans Kung, which has been published, called Brother or Lord. You know, that's the issue there. Not the denial of crucifixion and resurrection, but whether Jesus is simply a brother Jew or whether he's Lord of the universe. Do read it if you can. It's a fascinating study. So what we have seen is what different people, secular or Muslim or Hindu or Jewish, say about Jesus, but that raises the question, doesn't it? Did Jesus say anything about himself? And if he did, what did he say about himself? This is not as unproblematic as people might imagine, because there is a very prominent stream of New Testament study that denies that Jesus said anything much about himself. I mean, Jimmy Dunn, who has done distinguished work in New Testament study in a whole number of ways, particularly about the diversity of the New Testament, nevertheless holds that Jesus' kerygma, the Jesus' announcement of the gospel, was purely about the nature of the kingdom that was coming very soon, and the need, therefore, for repentance to be ready for the coming of that kingdom. Well, against that, and indeed before Jimmy Dunn, C.H. Dodd had laid out a completely different thesis, which was that not only did Jesus preach the coming of the kingdom, but he preached himself as what is known as autobasileia, as himself the kingdom. And this element has been recently reaffirmed by David Peterson, who was the principal of Oak Hill College until recently, and who's from the Diocese of Sydney, that indeed Jesus preached the kingdom, but he also saw himself at the center of the kingdom that he was preaching, and that how people responded to him was very important in terms of what their place in the kingdom might be. Brothers, there are some seats here next to the bishop, if anyone wants to. I mean, bishops do not suffer, let's put it this, from any kind of contagious disease. but most don't, yes. thank you, great. How are we going to settle this this issue? Well, let's look at some of the evidence. Some years ago, the BBC commissioned a series of films called The Miracles of Jesus. And in doing so, they commissioned a Muslim narrator called Umar Rage to do the narration for the film. And when I first heard about it, I thought to myself, there are about 2 billion Christians in the world. Why choose a Muslim to do the narration for a series on the miracles of Jesus? Well, that's the BBC for you. However, as it turned out, I have to admit, Umar Rage was actually very reverent about the evidence, and in some ways more reverent than some liberal Christian theologians might have been. I think this has to be said. The point is that in this series on the miracles of Jesus, Rage points out that Jesus understood some of his miracles to be pointing to his divine nature. This is not a Christian theologian saying it. This is a prominent, well-known Muslim journalist saying this on a BBC film. I mean, I don't know which bit is more significant. He pointed out, first of all, Jesus' miracles in nature, his authority, his dominion, therefore, over nature. And obviously, the calming of the storm, the stilling of the wind, the walking on water, all that, according to Rage, shows that Jesus is divine. Secondly, the miracles that show his dominion over the supernatural, nature and supernature, and the exorcisms, the casting out of evil spirits, show that Jesus is divine because he has authority over the devil. And thirdly, his tendency to forgive people their sins. So not simply the paralytic, but Zacchaeus, the woman who anointed his feet, the woman taken in adultery. There are many examples of this. And again, Rage says this would have been understood as meaning that Jesus was more than human. Who is it? Who is this who even forgives sins? They asked, as the Gospels say. Now, Rage makes the interesting point in this connection that he says that it is for this reason that the Quran does not emphasize the miracles of Jesus, because they lead to people thinking of his divine nature, of his divinity. I was surprised by this because, of course, I have always thought that the Quran does mention in a very significant way the miracles of Jesus. Some of them are miracles that are also mentioned in the canonical Gospels, like healing the sick, raising the dead, making the dumb speak and the lame walk and so on, the blind see. Some are drawn from the apocryphal Gospels, particularly, and you won't be surprised by this, by the Arabic Gospel of the Infancy. So there is a story, a very significant story in the Quran about Jesus making birds of clay and then breathing life into them and they fly away. Well, you know, if a miracle like that is mentioned, you then have to ask, who is it who breathes life into forms of clay and they become living beings? Well, in the Bible, that's said, of course, about the creation of humanity. So you have the miracles, as it were, as what Tom Wright called speech acts, where Jesus is making a claim by doing something, not saying something necessarily, but by doing something. Then secondly, Vinod Ramachandra, a very fine Sri Lankan evangelical theologian in his London lectures, has pointed out to Jesus' understanding of himself as shown in the Gospels as the divine wisdom. And a key text here is Matthew 11. You remember the disciples of John come to Jesus and say, you know, are you the Messiah or not? Tell us. And Jesus points to what is happening, the speech acts, if you like, the dead are raised, the lame are walking, the deaf are hearing, the dumb are speaking, the poor have the good news preached to them. And he says, blessed are those who take no offense at me. The reference, of course, is to Isaiah 35. And you know that Isaiah 35 is about the coming of God. And this is a curious thing, but very frequent in the New Testament, where references are made by Jesus or about Jesus in relation to the Older Testament, which are clearly about Yahweh. And nothing else. I mean, that's, you know, very cumulatively, the evidence is very strong. Anyway, once the disciples of John have gone back to report what they have heard to John the Baptist, Jesus addresses the crowds then. He says, you know, when you went out to see John, what did you go out to see? And then he chastises them, I suppose. He says, John came, neither eating nor drinking, and you did not believe him. The Son of Man has come eating and drinking, and you don't believe him either. But then he says, wisdom is justified by her deeds. And the rest of chapter 11 is given to an understanding of how Jesus is the wisdom. He is the one who gathers the simple, the unlearned, around him, the poor, just as wisdom is shown to be doing in the book of Proverbs. Then he says, take my yoke upon yourselves and learn from me, for I am meek and humble of heart. And that is taken directly from something said about wisdom in the apocryphal book of Ecclesiasticus. In the next chapter, in chapter 12 of Matthew's Gospel, it is even clearer, according to Ramachandra. And this is about the Queen of the South. You know, in chapter 12, you have the argument from the lesser to the greater. So just as Jonah was in the belly of the whale, the Son of Man will be in the earth and rise again as Jonah came out of the whale and so forth. And then he says, the queen of the south, that's Yemen, by the way. That's what it means, the queen of the south. Yemen is still south in Arabic. The queen of the south came to listen to the wisdom of Solomon. But someone greater than Solomon is here. See, what is greater, what wisdom is greater than the wisdom of Solomon? And there are many such incidents and instances that Ramachandra points out in his work about Jesus' understanding of himself as divine wisdom. I think it was in 1974, as far as I can remember, that Professor Charlie Moe of Cambridge University called our attention to the importance of the definite article. The definite article in Jesus referring to himself and in the evangelist referring to him as the Son of Man. So it's not just the Son of Man, it is the Son of Man. The Son of Man. He said, you know, the definite article is very important, so it's ho huios to anthropo. And I, you know, I file that away for future reference in my mind, but recently a young scholar from the Diocese of Rochester, as it happens, Andy Angel, I think you will hear more about him. He's the son of Gervase Angel, that some people may know about, a great Sam's missionary. Andy is an Aramaic expert, and wonderful to have young clergy being experts in things like Aramaic. I mean, we need that, and of course you need young clergy to do that, because you know, once you're past a certain age, languages are more and more difficult. But Andy is an expert in Aramaic, and he has shown that the Aramaic of Jesus' time had a general use for the term Son of Man, which could mean simply mankind in general, or it could mean me as an instance of mankind in general. That was the general use. And an emphatic use, which meant a particular son of a particular figure. Now, the study that Andy has done shows that if the evangelists were wanting to translate into Greek the language in which they were writing, Jesus referring to himself as the Son of Man simply to mean I as one human being, one of humanity, that they could have translated such a general reference as huios anthropou without the definite articles. There's plenty of evidence he has shown in his work that this could be done from Aramaic into Greek. The fact that they did not do so and actually translated it ho huios to anthropou suggests that Jesus was using the emphatic form in Aramaic and was therefore referring to a specific figure, no doubt the one we are first introduced to in Daniel 7. Now, if that is the case, and I think Tom Wright in a different way has also shown this to be the case, Daniel 7 is quite suggestive in a number of respects. First of all, of course, this is the section in Daniel that is not in Hebrew but in Aramaic. So the terminology fits very well. Secondly, there was a lot of rabbinic speculation about the thrones. You remember at the beginning of the vision, thrones are placed. And then the Ancient of Days comes and takes his seat and all that. And the rabbinic speculation was that one of the thrones, one of the divine thrones, would be for the Messiah. However, in addition to that, when it says in Daniel 7:14, I think it is, that all authority and dominion and so forth will be given to him, all nations will what? Remember what? Yes, serve him sometimes, bow down. It's actually the Aramaic word that is used, yaflahuna, is related, funnily enough, to a common Arabic word which is still used. The verb is falaha, from which we get the word falaheen. Who are the falaheen? The falaheen are the workers, the peasants in Egypt. But in Aramaic, falaha as a verb is used only for the service of God. There is no instance of this verb being used for anything else but the service of deity, whether in pagan instances or in Jewish instances. So when Daniel 7 says, all nations shall serve him, worship him, that is an indication of the divine status of the Son of Man. What about Messiah? We all know now, don't we? I mean, we live in post-critical times, that Jesus was reluctant to accept the title Messiah for himself, and that this may have been partly because of the political overtones that the title had at that time, and even perhaps military overtones, that the Messiah would win political domination for the Jewish people through military means. I mean, this is certainly what Bar Kokhba did in the next generation or two. And he was certainly acclaimed Messiah by some. So the way it goes is that Jesus was reluctant to accept this title because of its political and military overtones that it had acquired. Well, there may be something in that. Tom Wright points out in Jesus and the Victory of God that the expectation of the Messiah at the time of Jesus was that of a purely human figure. Well, that may be, but that is not what we find in the Old Testament. See, in Ezekiel 34, where God is saying he is now to be the shepherd of his people because the other shepherds had proved faithless. And as soon as he has said that, David is immediately associated with the shepherding of God. And my servant David will be shepherd. Well, this is the same kind of association that we find in Daniel 7 with the thrones of the Son of Man with the Ancient of Days. Here it is the Messianic King who is associated with the shepherding work of God. In Psalm 2, of course, it is said explicitly, a great messianic psalm, you are my son, this day I have begotten you. Psalm 89, another messianic psalm, same thing. But to me, I think the clincher is Psalm 45, where it says about the Messiah, your throne, O God, is forever and ever. About the Messiah, that is said. So the point is that it may be that Jesus' reluctance to accept the title of Messiah from his contemporaries was because they had not grasped its full implications about the divine nature of the Messiah, and not simply because of the political and military overtones. Tom Wright actually, in another work of his, does show the connection between the Son of Man figure, the heavenly Son of Man, and the Messiah in Jewish apocalyptic thought at the time of Jesus or thereabouts. What about Son of God? You may have picked up recent controversy about translations of the Bible meant for the Islamic world made by reputable Bible translation people which took the decision in the light of dynamic equivalence theory to omit the terms Father and Son in speaking of Jesus and God from the Gospels. There was a petition organized and attracted large numbers of signatures, which in the end led Wycliffe, who were responsible for this particular translation, to suspend the distribution of the translation. They had done this because they did not want to offend Muslims. So the word father was translated guardian. Sounds vaguely platonic to me. The word son was translated representative. This was judged by many people, many missionaries, pastors in the Muslim world, as grossly inadequate. So why do we speak of Jesus as the Son of God? Well, there are all sorts of historical and biblical reasons. But the one that I would like to mention this afternoon is Jesus' consciousness of his intimacy with his Father. What you might call an internal, almost mystical reason. It's not historical or going back to the witness of the Old Testament or whatever, but nevertheless, it is impossible for us to understand the meaning of Jesus' mission without understanding this deep sense of intimacy that he had with his Father. And again, Matthew 11, how a significant chapter in the Synoptic Gospels it is. No one knows the Son except the Father, and no one knows the Father except the Son, and those to whom the Son has revealed him. And of course, that line of thought is greatly developed in St. John's Gospel. So, when we think about the person of Christ and want to give an adequate answer to people of other faiths or to secularists, to detractors like Pullman, these are the sorts of things that we have to take into consideration. It is true, of course, that we cannot understand the person of Jesus Christ without understanding something of his work. And I just want to say a little bit about that before I sit down, Mark, unless you want to break now.
No, press on.
Yeah, it'll just take a few more minutes and then we'll have a natural breaking point if you will allow me to do this. In our own times, by which I mean the last 200 years or so, there is a sense of brokenness in society. So Hegel, for instance, spoke of human conflict with nature in human society, and most importantly, he spoke of the conflict that we have with the very ground of our being. Marx, on the other hand, saw human alienation as alienation from what we make, because in modern industrial society, people do not normally own what they make. That is owned by the entrepreneur or the industrialist or whatever, and so the worker is alienated from his product. And also Marx said, the worker is also alienated from other workers because it is in the interests of efficiency in production and also in the interests of the entrepreneur that workers don't stand in solidarity with one another, but for reasons of production and other things are separated from one another. And then Freud, of course, the great guru who sort of overshadows everything these days, spoke of the inner cleavage, that there is an inner division in us which needs to be overcome. And of course, that is overcome from his point of view through psychoanalysis. But there is this sense of alienation, of conflict, of division in humanity, in those people who have most influenced us, consciously or unconsciously, in modern times. I don't know if people still read a man called Dr. Dilliston, F.W. Dilliston. Fitz recognizes the name, Bishop Mark. Christian Understanding of the Atonement, very fine book. But Dilliston taught me for a while, and he had shown that this sense of alienation, of there being something wrong, of a brokenness, is not just a modern phenomenon, that this also existed in the ancient world, and that it actually has to do with being human as such. That there is the sense of an original harmony that has been disrupted. And there is then the desire to recover this harmony. He called it a nostalgia for paradise. Nostalgia for paradise. His work was in three main civilizations of the ancient world, Egypt, India, and China, where he showed how this sense of the disruption of an original harmony is felt, and how the recovery of this harmony is made out, of course, through sacrifice. I mean, that's the point, that in every civilization, he shows that sacrifice is the way in which harmony is to be recovered, whether that is of animals or cereals or libations of drink or whatever it may be. Now, the point is that when we come to the Bible, we have this same sense of something gone wrong that has to be put right. But we also have a difference that in all these other civilizations that Deliston has studied, the sacrifices are usually related to the renewal of nature. On the whole, although there are some nature festivals in the Bible, on the whole, you don't have this in the sacrificial system of the Bible. So what you have is, on the one hand, communion sacrifices, like the Passover, where the believers participate in the sacrifice to achieve the benefit of God's saving acts in one way or another. On the other hand, you have the sin offering. Now, to me anyway, one important thing about the sin offering in the Hebrew Bible is that the most important words for the sin offering are also the most important words for the sin of which they are an offering. So Asham and Chatat, I mean, there are biblical scholars here, they may wish to comment on this. This is hugely important for our understanding of the work of Christ. So when the New Testament says that he who knew no sin became for us sin, you could equally say he who knew no sin became for us the sin offering. Certainly makes it more understandable to me. And of course, at the heart of the sin offering is the idea of substitution. Now, in the Hebrew Bible itself, there is a development of thought, isn't there? The former chief rabbi in Britain says that there is a strange attitude to sacrifice in the Old Testament. You have both the desire for sacrifice and a critique of it. You know, the prophets are constantly criticizing the sacrificial cult and are saying something more is to be desired. I mean, we are in Lent, and you won't need to be reminded of what it is they say is to be desired. A broken spirit and a contrite heart, O God, thou wilt not despise. And it is this sacrifice of ourselves that is desired, and this is brought to a climax in Psalm 40, where the Messiah says of his coming, sacrifices and burnt offerings you have not desired, but a body you have given me in the Septuagint. Lo, I have come to do your will, O Lord. And the writer of the Epistle to the Hebrews, of course, picks this up to develop his view about Christ's sacrifice. But how is this self-sacrifice to be brought about in this state of alienation? I mean, that is the question that has to be asked in relation to the work of Christ? How is this sacrifice that God requires even to be possible? And as the writer to the Hebrews says, and St. Paul says in many of his letters, it is only brought about because the sacrifice of Christ makes it possible for our sacrifice to be acceptable in God's presence. When we think of this sacrifice of Christ, obviously there is a valid way of understanding the atonement in subjective terms. I mean, that should not be denied. That is certainly an aspect of the atonement that needs to be noticed. The first aspect of this subjective view of the atonement is the sacrifice of Jesus being an example for us. And Jesus himself says that, doesn't he? When you remember at Peter's confession, when Jesus says that the Son of Man must suffer many things, then when Peter says, "This will not happen to you, Lord," and is rebuked for saying that, Jesus then says, "But if you are to be my disciples, you must also take up your cross and follow me." And this exemplary view of the atonement, summed up in the teaching of Abelard, for instance — I don't know if people have seen the play Abelard and Heloise, but it is a very suggestive play about a very subtle and profound theologian who's quite underrated in some ways — but his emphasis on this exemplary aspect of the atonement is valid. And as I was saying earlier, this is also something that is very attractive to the Sufis, to the Muslim Sufis. Although Orthodox Islam denies the cross, many Muslim Sufis affirm it as an example of supreme renunciation. One of them says, "Unless you put your back on the cross, you cannot claim that you have renounced everything." In fact, he says, "Unless you put your backs on the cross as Jesus did, you will not." Rumi, the great Sufi mystic, great favorite of Prince Charles, by the way, says, "By love, the cross has become a throne. By love, the king has become a slave." Philippians 2, as you were praying, Bishop Mark, just now. "And by love, the dead are raised to life again." This is the Muslim Sufi mystic saying it, by the way. Very popular with the New Age these days. So, yes, there is a place for an exemplary understanding of the atonement in that sense. But, of course, there is another sense to the exemplary view of the atonement, which is that the atonement is not just about being an example to us in our following of Christ, but the atonement also shows us what God is like. So this is Bill Vanston's Love's Endeavor, Love's Expense. "Therefore he who shows us God," how does it go? "Helpless hangs upon the tree, and the nails and crown of thorns shows us what God's love must be." You see? That the cross reveals to us a suffering God. I mean, that's. However, now you'd expect me to say this, this is not enough. I mean, a subjective view of the atonement is necessary, but not enough, because we also need an objective view. And I want to say just three very brief things about that and then sit down. The first element of in a properly objective view of the atonement is that of representativeness. A second Adam to the fight and to the rescue came, as we sing in John Henry Newman's great hymn. That Jesus is representative of humanity, and Tom Wright has shown how important this figure, this representative figure, is as standing for the whole people of God. This is, in fact, one of the ways in which Daniel 7 presents the Son of Man as standing for the whole suffering people of God. It is because of this representativeness that we are included in what Christ does, in Christ's obedience, in the making possible, if you like, of that obedience for us. He is at the head and is the leader of the new humanity he is creating as representative. A second Adam, a new Adam to the fight and to the rescue came. But he is also substitute. And I pointed out that we cannot understand the idea of sacrifice in the Bible without understanding the idea of substitution. That which is put in the place of the sinner to deal with the sin of the sinner. And when we think of Jesus as our substitute in terms of his sacrifice, of his suffering and death, what we are saying is that he has done, first of all, what we were unable to do. What we are unable to do. So someone had to do it. Secondly, he has done what we were unwilling to do. That is the extent of God's grace, that he does for us what we are not even minded to do. He has done what we were unwilling to do, and in doing this, he has turned away God's anger from our rebellion. He has therefore opened the way of friendship with God, of reconciliation with God, and this has involved him, as he has done this in our place, in taking that punishment which was actually due to us. Who has inflicted that punishment or whatever is not the point. I mean, the point is that the punishment of death, which was ours, was necessarily taken by Jesus so that he could stand in our place, so that he could do what we were unable and unwilling to do. That is, in fact, what happened. I think if we think of substitution in this way, as the one who stands in our place to do what we are unable and unwilling to do, to turn away God's anger from our sin, we can meet some of the objections that are sometimes made to a substitutionary way of thinking about the atonement. And it is not necessary. Some of the things that those who object to this theory, some of the things they believe are necessary to this theory are not, in fact, necessary. The third aspect of this objective view of the atonement is, of course, Jesus as the victor. This is known as the classic view of the atonement. Athanasius, for example, said that because Jesus died for all and because death could not hold him, therefore, his death is a victory for all. Quite a lot of Luther's theology is given the vigor that it has because of this sense of the cross being a victory. In medieval times, the popularity of the harrowing of hell in art, for instance, was about this victory. Now, we don't have to buy everything that was said about this in the Middle Ages. I mean, there were some strange things that were said. Jesus was thought of, for example, as the worm that baited the devil on a hook. You know, Psalm 22, I'm a worm and no man. That's how the devil was caught by God. Well, yeah, okay. That God made a bargain with the devil, Jesus for all the souls in hell. And the devil thought he'd got a very good bargain, but actually because hell could not hold Jesus, he lost everything, and so on. But I think that this Christus Victor idea is very important if we are to think of the objective, the results of the sacrifice of Christ in our lives, in the church, and in the world. So Bishop Mark, if I may stop here and see what people have to say, and then if there is time, I would like to go on to say something about the Lordship of Christ in culture and also the relationship of Christ to the religions. Thank you very much indeed.
Would you like to take some questions now?
Certainly.
Okay. Bishop Nasrallah, as you were talking about the doctrine of the atonement, you mentioned, well, actually before you got to that section, about C.H. Dodd. He made a distinction. Actually, he was in favor of the term expiation as opposed to the term propitiation. Do you want to say something about that?
Yes. Well, I don't want to, but I shall. I think in the atonement there is an element both of expiation and of propitiation. Expiation has to do with how sinful humanity deals with its own sinfulness. You know, I have something to expiate, a pettiness, as the poet said. Expiation is an important aspect of the whole notion of sacrifice, and therefore of the sacrifice of Christ. But propitiation, I don't think you can understand substitution and sacrifice without having at least some sense of the sacrifice being propitiation. That is to say, dealing with God's displeasure, God's anger, God's wrath, however you want to put it, at human sinfulness, human rebellion, waywardness, whatever it is. Because that also has to be. It's not just that man has to do something, but there also has to be something done on God's part as a result of the sacrifice. I think that the kind of liberal aversion to propitiation as a possible translation sometimes even in the New Testament has to do with a predetermined view of who God is and what God is like. But the God of the Bible is surely a God who can be wrathful and angry at human sin. And we shouldn't deny that. Actually, John Robinson, you know, the honest to God John Robinson, who was a better New Testament scholar than a theologian, and that is often a distinction that should be made. But he said in a very interesting commentary on the letter to the Romans, called Wrestling with Romans, he said, God is only love. Those who respond to that love experience it as love. Those who remain turned away from that love experience it as wrath. And I think that about sums it up. But that then has to be dealt with, not just in terms of expiation, but propitiation. But people may want to add something to this.
We mispronounce wrath as wrath.
Yeah, I know you do. Yeah. Well, I don't know about mispronounce. You'll pronounce it differently.
I knew that that's what you were saying.
Yeah, all right, yes, okay. Thank
you. Another question, please. In view of your astonishing things you said about Muslims' awareness of Jesus,
yeah.
Do you have any insight as to why the Muslim culture, the Muslim mind, holds Muhammad and Muhammad's teachings higher than that of Jesus?
Mm. Yes, this is a very important. I mean, I've wrestled with this question all of my life. I think there are a number of reasons for it. On the face of it, let me say this first. On the face of it, even if you just limit it to the Quran, Jesus is a more remarkable figure, even if you limit it to the Quran. So why does the Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, become so important then in Islam? And it was Samuel Zweymer, actually, the great missionary to the Muslims, who put his finger on it. He said that the reason this has happened is that progressively Muslims have invested Muhammad with all that properly belongs to Christ. That Muhammad himself never claimed for himself. I mean, he never claimed to be the Messiah. The only person who's called the Messiah in the Quran is Jesus. More and more, there is a popular book of devotions that Muslims use in which, you know, God has 99 beautiful names according to Muslims, but Muhammad has 201. And it is very instructive to read some of them. He's called Savior of the World. He's called Messiah. He's called the Holy Spirit, etc. Now, it is demonstrably the case that he never claimed any of these things for himself. But so I think that is one reason why, that what properly belongs to Christ has been given to someone who never himself claimed it. Part of the task of Christian witness in Muslim context and to Muslims is patiently to unravel all of that. To say, well, actually, who is Jesus Christ? We have just produced a DVD, I haven't got it with me, regrettably, along with Operation Mobilization, some Cambridge scholars and I, called The Jesus Accounts, in which we have tried to remove some of these, false ideas that have developed so that when Muslims are presented with the gospel, they don't resist it because of these other ideas that have developed. And I was told by those who had produced the DVD that at the Istanbul Book Fair, it sold 10,000 copies. So praise the Lord for that. It's now been translated into Farsi and Urdu and Turkish. But it's also quite a useful thing to give secular people if they want to know what the gospel say Jesus is.
What's the name of the DVD?
The Jesus Accounts.